when I invite you to turn in your Bible to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 as we make our way through the book of 1 Corinthians. If you don't have your Bible, there's a red orange pew Bible you can use here. 1 Corinthians is in the back half, chapter 11 on page 173. Finally, I know you've been waiting for this, probably for the last 15 years, for the entirety of our ministry. Pastor Rich, when are we going to talk about head coverings? Oh my gosh. Holy cow. Okay. That's good. Kudos to you, babe. Deep respect, unbelievable. Holy cow. I am just absolutely flabbergasted. That's incredible. That's really good. So see, you have been waiting for it. Just, you planned this, what, 15 years ago? Whenever we talk about head coverings, we're going to do this. This passage is, according to most commentators, if not the most difficult text in the entire Bible, and particularly in the New Testament. It certainly is one of the most difficult, which is why I want to start our reflections off with this one thought, which will connect to two people in this crowd. The rest of you will get this. Jethro Tull, big band in the 70s, one of my favorites, one of the few bands with a flute player playing rock and flute. Jethro Tull released an album called, I'm going to forget the name of the album now. Let me look here if I wrote it down. Thick as a Brick. Thick as a Brick. It's a masterpiece. 42-minute long song. Back in the days of vinyl, you had to split the song up. It fades out after 21 minutes on side one, and it then resumes, fades in on side two. 42-minute long song. Absolutely epic for those of us who love that kind of insanity with music. But probably hard for most people to really appreciate. So the very opening lines of the song, if you ever listen to just the first 3 minutes, the opening line of the song is, "I really don't mind if you sit this one out." That's the opening line. "I really don't mind if you sit this one out," which is Jethro Tull's band way of saying, hey, you know, if you bypass this album, it's okay. We'll get it. It's not 10 songs. It's one song. It's not 10 3 to 5 minute long songs. It's one 42 minute long song. And so if you sit this out, we get it. It's complex. It's difficult. It's not for everyone. And so if this doesn't do it for you, feel free to move on to the next album. Catch us on the next tour. So, I love how that opens, and I really could say that in this passage. I really don't mind if you sit this one out. I'm glad to see you're all here, and I really don't want you to leave, but I don't think you'd miss anything if you sat this one out, because I'm not sure how much connection this will have to us in our modern world, with one exception, and perhaps one other thought, that sometimes there are passages so complex, so difficult, so hard, that we need to appreciate the challenge of what it means to try to understand a book that is 2 to 5,000 years old. You know, you go back to some of the earliest stuff, we got a book that's really old. It has a completely different culture, different economy, different politics, different everything. It is very foreign to us. We're always entering a strange world when it comes to Scripture, and we're always having to wrestle with how we fuse the ancient horizon with our present horizon. But this particular passage brings incredible difficulties, more than normal. There are a number of cultural items in the text we're about to read which don't connect to us at all. It's no longer considered to be sexually suggestive if you wear your hair long and loose as a woman. A head covering for a woman does not have any significance for most of us in the modern world. Long hair on a man is not a significant issue for us in our modern day culture. There are all kinds of elements that just have no connection to us, and we're just going to have to try to get into this world to understand what's going on. And then on top of that, there are disagreements about the meaning of key terms. Disagreements over the meaning of head. What does that mean? Disagreements over the meaning of covering. What exactly are we talking about? And then to add to the confusion, there is for some an offense that they feel innately as they read this text. Because on the surface, if you don't know Paul well, it can appear that this is very patriarchal, sexist, and perhaps even misogynist. I'm going to assure you before we're done, I don't think it's that at all. But there are some that read this and they are repulsed right away because they just can't even imagine that Paul would suggest some of the things he's going to suggest. So it's difficult on so many levels. So, I really don't mind if you sit this one out. I'm going to do my best to get through it. I think that I see a path through this, but it's not without wrinkles. And so, just if you will, indulge me, do your best to follow along, because we're going to try to explain this as best, at least as I'm able. But I think before we try to explain it, we're going to handle this differently than normal. Instead of going line by line, let me read through the whole thing, because it has problematic elements throughout the entire thing that we're going to address right up front. So if you'll follow along as I read, Chapter 11, verse 2. I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions just as I handed them on to you. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the husband is the head of his wife, and God is the head of Christ. Any man who prays or prophesies with something on his head disgraces his head. But any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled disgraces her head. It is one and the same thing as having her head shaved. For if a woman will not veil herself, then she should cut off her hair. But it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or to be shaved. She should wear a veil. For a man ought not to have his head veiled, since he is the image and reflection of God. But woman is the reflection of man. Indeed, man was not made for woman, but woman for man. Neither was man created for the sake of woman, but woman for the sake of man. For this reason, a woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, or man independent of woman. For just as woman came from man, so man comes through woman. But all things come from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head unveiled? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is degrading to him, but if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. But if anyone is disposed to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor did the churches of God. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. And the confusion persists. Because there are so many elements, as I said, right up front, that have no connection to our modern day culture. There are words that are challenging. There are words that our NRSV really screws the pooch with. Verse 3. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and not the husband. This isn't the Greek word for husband. It's the man is the head of, and that's not the word for wife. It's the word for woman. So we're not dealing with husband and wife. It's just man and woman issues. The word veil, the NRSV uses over and over. The word veil is not found in the Greek. It is the word katakalupto, covering. And the question is, what's the covering? Well, this has interpreted that the covering's a veil. I think that doesn't help us right from the get-go. And then you have the issue where he's talking about hair and using that as a covering. And so all of this leads to a lot of confusion. So in order to try to bring some sense to this, to try to understand what's going on in Paul's world in the Corinthian church, we might not be able to bring any of it into our world, but what's going on there and what is he addressing? Let me help you with what I've come to discover or to conclude by working through some of the challenges first off. The word head, which you saw again and again, and we're talking about a covering on the head and disgracing the head, is kephale. Kephale can have a number of possible meanings. It has a literal meaning, of course. It's just your cranium. It's your noggin. It has a couple metaphorical meanings. To be a head over something can mean to have authority over or to have a certain headship. Mrs. Jones is the head of her company. That's the idea that she has authority over it. She has a certain headship. That doesn't necessarily imply any kind of subordination. Her colleagues may be equals, but she is the one responsible. She's the one in charge. She's the one in authority. So it doesn't necessarily connotate any kind of inferiority on behalf of others or subordination. It just shows that she has authority. Well, I think that's the best, and we're going to go with that. But before we do, you need to know that others have desperately tried to say one of the minor uses of the word kephali is the word for source, like the headwaters of the Nile flow from Lake Victoria. So Lake Victoria is the head or the source of the waters in the Nile. The Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, is called the head of the year. It's the first day, not because it has authority over the other 364 days, it is the first day, and it's the head of the year because all the other days flow from it. Well, that's a very creative and innovative way to come at head, but I don't really think it addresses this text and deals with all the problems that arise once you go down. I think it breaks down. We can talk more about that when it comes to discussion time if that remains a question. But believe me, there are many other questions that are going to come up before then. I think the way I'm going to come at it is the traditional idea, not headship per se. I don't like that word. And before we're done, we're going to talk about certain Christian ministries that use this as their base text to prove male headship in a household. They use an obscure, difficult, challenging text as the ground for, yes, the man's the head of the household. Okay? So that's why I'm a little bit uncomfortable using the word headship, and that's why I'm going to use different words, like it has to do with being preeminent, being at the top, which isn't to say that all others are in an inferior position, because if you'll notice, Christ has a head. You look at the end of verse 3, God is the head of Christ, and we know that Christ is not inferior to God. Christ is the Word of God, who was in the beginning with God, and there's a certain equality and mutual love. And so there's not a sense of inferiority as much as there is a position of authority. Christ lived his entire life seeking to do the will of the Father, placing himself under the authority of God in order to manifest the presence of God in our lives. So I'm going to look at head as authority. That's the first challenge, and I'm going to choose authority. The second challenge is much more difficult. It's this crazy word for veil. Katakalupta. It's translated veil again and again in the NRSV, but that's not the only way you could read it. In fact, veil, I think, takes us down the wrong path right from the beginning. Because people who translate this veil assume that Paul is incorporating his Jewish custom that in a Jewish household, if you were a married woman, you wore a veil. I mean, that's what you did. It identified that you're married. And we should know by now in reading 1 Corinthians, to the Jew I became a Jew, to the Greek a Greek, and all that, that Paul's not concerned with importing Jewish customs to the Greco-Roman community. So I don't think he's talking about any kind of bridal or married veil at all. He's talking about some kind of covering that Greco women either did or didn't wear, and that's where some of the confusion arises. And the challenge of this. Some commentators will say it was not normal for women in Greco-Roman cultures to be veiled. Most of them would say it's normal. I agree with those who say that it's normal. You look at many of the Greco-Roman statues, when you have women, they always tend to have a veil because in public, that was kind of public decorum. You wore a veil in public, but in your home, you let your hair down. You took off the veil. When you went in public, if you didn't wear a veil, you didn't wear your hair wild and loose, because then you could be perhaps mistaken for a prostitute who is wearing her hair wild and loose in order to attract attention to herself to gain some business. So you'd wear your hair at least bound. It wouldn't be wild and loose. So you'd either wear some kind of public headdress or covering, or you'd have your hair in a way that didn't suggest that you were available. So that was a big deal in Greco-Roman society, and I think that's perhaps what's going on with covering. And you'll see once you realize that this actually connects more to hair or just simply to a covering. And the word katakalupto literally means to cover up. It doesn't mean veil. It's not there in the text. This is a really poor interpretation, not a translation, when they're throwing in the word veil. It means cover up. And covering up could simply mean putting your hair in a style that fit public decorum of the day, that didn't suggest you were sexually loose, that didn't suggest you were a prostitute, or didn't suggest that you'd just come out of some pagan frenzied revelry in the temple of Aphrodite, that you were a proper woman, a respectable, decent woman. So when we talk about
covering her hair, that's what seems to be at issue. Wild, loose hair that suggests promiscuity, perhaps even prostitution or pagan revelry, versus hair that just is hair, or hair that's pulled back, or having some kind of covering. All of those would be suggestions in a Greco-Roman society that you are a decent, respectable woman. Okay? A lot of stuff to cover, because there's one other challenge. The challenge of looking at this, and as you read through it out loud with me, it's easy to see why some immediately have this knee-jerk reaction. And they say, oh boy, this is just so patriarchal or misogynist. But I want to draw your attention to a couple of things that makes me think, if Paul is going in that direction, he's taking 10 steps backward. And in fact, for those who instantly think he's thinking that, they're not really paying attention to the text in the first place, because there's some interesting balances Paul does. They might not seem balanced enough to us, but in his culture, he's really giving a balance. Let me show you. For example, verse 8. Man was not made from woman, but woman from man. And you think, okay, all right, Paul, talking about man here. But then notice in verse 11, nevertheless, in the Lord, woman's not independent of man, and man's not independent of woman, because just as I said, woman came from man, now I'm going to say, verse 12, just as woman came from man, so man comes through woman. So they're interdependent. There's a mutuality. And all things come from God. And so he wants to highlight that there is this dance, this interplay, this connection, that one comes from one, but one comes from the other. They're both dependent on each other. And if he's thinking about the Genesis 2 story, and he might be, the Genesis 2 story is that God took a rib and created the woman. But every single man since then has come from the woman. So if he's thinking of that, and then you have to realize we sometimes read Genesis 2 in a very sexist way, because the idea of coming from a rib is to show equality, to show connection, to show mutuality, not to show some kind of hierarchy that Adam's great and Eve's, you know, just pulled from his rib. Instead of, the story is about how none of the animals really are a satisfying partner, and finally he finds someone that he can share dignity with, share respect, share collegiality, share life with, who is his equal, who is his partner. In fact, is his helper, and the word helper in the Old Testament is only used of Eve and of God, which is to say, in a very important helper. And that then you come back to verse 3, which can seem very sexist, but you start to realize maybe Paul's speaking in this way. Once you understand Christ is the head of every man, and the man, not the husband, because this isn't the word husband, it's the word for man, is the head of his wife, or the head of woman. God is the head of Christ. That's not the passage I was wanting to draw your attention to. It is verse 7. A man ought not to have his head veiled, since he's the image and reflection. And the word reflection is really doxa, glory. He's the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. And that's the word generically for man. And it could mean just man as a sex. It could be mankind. So if you really wanted to get, you know, total feminist on this, woman is the glory of humankind. So there you go. I don't think Paul would be opposed to that, because he sees there being a mutual camaraderie, that there's an interdependence and a play between the sexes, that both need one another and both come from one another, and yet all come from God. And so instead of being sexist, you have that balance Paul's trying to present, as well as this. Not only is he showing a mutual submission, not only is he showing an interdependence, but do you remember back in 1 Corinthians 7? The man has authority over the woman, and the woman has authority over the man. That's as progressive as you can get in his day. No one else is saying that. That the woman has authority over her husband, just as the man has rights or authority over her. There's an equality and a mutual submission. Then you add this one last fact. Verse 5. Any woman who prays or prophesies, and here's what we sometimes don't feel as strongly as I guarantee the Corinthian community, church, and the Corinthian culture was agape and shocked by. Women don't prophesy. They're not rhetoricians. It's all males. It's a male business. Prophecy, to speak authoritatively to an assembly, is something in the synagogues only a man does. It is not something that a woman does. But Paul here has no problem saying, hey, the women need to be prophesying. Prophesying doesn't mean ecstatic. It means teaching and instructing. We'll see that in chapter 14. If I speak five words and no one understands, I'm not prophesying. People need to know what I'm saying. They need to learn. They need to be instructed. And so the fact that a woman is standing prophesying in a position of authority in an assembly of men and women is Paul's way of making it very clear he's not talking about subordination or female submission. He is placing the woman at the head. He's putting her in a position where she's at the top and speaking in a position of authority to everyone, including males in the assembly. So that's why I think if we do a knee-jerk and say Paul's being, you know, misogynist or sexist, we're not seeing and hearing what Paul's trying to do. He's trying to balance things, balance the scales. He's also clearly doing something no one else is doing and saying women have every right to have the authority to prophesy. The question is, how are they going to use that authority and how will it be perceived by others? And that's where the covering comes in. And this is where we take all these challenges we've had and realize this is what may have been going on in the Corinthian community. This is my suggestion. A number of commentators would go along with me. I have some backing from scholars, but because this is such a difficult text, you'll find that all across the board people have different opinions. So I'm going to give you my best shot at it. So here goes. What seems to be going on here is everything's arising from the gospel. Look at verse 2. I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions just as I handed them on to you. The tradition Paul hands on is I preach Christ and Him crucified. The tradition is I present the gospel of forgiveness of sins, the good news of liberation, the good news of grace, the good news of God coming to us in Jesus Christ. That means, as Paul will say in Galatians, that there's neither male nor female, free or slave, Jew or Greek, but all are one in Christ. He's already hinted at that in chapter 7 with the mutual rights that male and female have over one another. And so there's a new liberation in the gospel, which comes from the gospel, that when the people come together in worship, women are playing an equal role. They are also praying and they're also prophesying in the assembly. They're not set apart, women with women, men with men, but women are prophesying and preaching with Paul's endorsement, because Joel says when the Messiah comes, the young men will dream dreams, the old men will have visions, and the women will prophesy. He understands that that's what new covenant means, that all these things that divide us have been removed and the gospel is for all equally. And that means the women have the freedom to prophesy. Well, that's a good thing. They've got it. They understand that. He's happy they're doing that. It's just in the execution that he's a little troubled, because some of the women acting in freedom have gone too far. And isn't that been a common theme in 1 Corinthians? You have freedom, but you just take it a little bit too far. You destroy your brother because I have the freedom to eat this meat sacrificed to idol and you don't. So you abuse your freedom because you take it just a little too far. It seems like some of the women have begun to remove what is proper public decorum. A head covering or keeping your hair in a way that doesn't look like you are a prostitute. And they've decided, you know, free liberation means we don't even have to follow any public decorum. We don't even have to worry about how our hair is kept or unkempt when we might be associated with pride. We don't care because we're free. And it's actually true they're free. But they're doing that as a sign of freedom, and some in the Corinthian community don't know what to make of it because it seems to be so connected to prostitution or to pagan revelry. Others are just fine with it, saying, yeah, they're free. Let them go. Wild hair and all. Let your hair down, baby. So that what's happening is you have this going on coupled with the reality that there is a dissolution of public and private when you're meeting in your own home to worship. Because remember, up through the first 3 centuries, there were no church buildings. When you came together as church, you met at someone's home, which is a private space. And if you're in a private space, your own home, say the woman is the patron, she's one of the wealthy ones, and she's inviting people to the home. It was customary for a Greco woman, Roman woman, to let her hair down in private. But you're inviting people to your assembly, and some visitors could come in, so that is it private because it's your home? Or is it public because it's a church assembly? And I think Paul concludes it's a public meeting. And yet some are acting with this new liberation that it's just private. And so in my own home, I wear my pajamas. In my own home, I let my hair down. If you're coming to my home and we're going to have our worship assembly here, well, I put on a head covering when I go in public, I go to market, when I go to some kind of guild, I bind my hair because I know people might perceive me wrongly if I let it wear loose, but I don't worry about that at home, and this is home. It's private. Do you see the problem that could develop? It's perceived as private, but really it's public. And I think Paul understands that the solution to this problem is very simple. When you meet together in your homes, you're liberated, you're free to prophesy, but maintain public decorum because it's a public meeting. Maintain the public decorum you'd have at market or if you went to guild. Which means if you went to public, you'd wear a head covering. Would a man wear a head covering going to market? No. Would a woman? Yes, or at least have her hair so it's not loose and in any way being associated with sexual suggestiveness. I think for Paul, that's like problem solved. Simply and honestly, it's only appropriate to follow public decorum in the public assembly, even though you're meeting in a private home. So, I think what's happening is here is Paul clearly wants the women to feel free to prophesy in public assembly. He just wants them to follow public decorum. And he wants them to follow public decorum so they don't draw attention to themselves. Because if you're prophesying, you're not supposed to be drawing attention to yourself. If you're preaching, if you're teaching, if you're instructing, if you're speaking of Christ Jesus, the goal is not to point to yourself, to make people focus on you and how your hair looks or how you're dressed or, you know, all of that. The focus is supposed to be on instructing people in the way of Christ. So I think what's happening here is Paul is saying a bared head or wild hair would be seen as inappropriate exposure in culture. So when you're leading worship and all eyes are on you, be sensitive to your cultural setting. And I think Paul finds this particularly important because all of these churches are meeting in the shadow of the temple of Aphrodite, where all the women let their hair down in sexual suggestiveness and go crazy in frenzied ecstasy. So he doesn't want there to be any connection to pagan worship. He also doesn't want them to be mistaken for not caring for what is just public decorum, for either head covering or having hair in a respectable manner. That's his only concern. What I want you to hear real strongly at this point, his only concern is this text, is how the head is attired when you're prophesying. That's all. He's not talking about male headship or female subordination. He's not talking about how women should act in other situations. He has one thing he's focused on, and that is when you're speaking in the public setting in the church assembly, do not in your liberation abuse that liberation by taking it to the extent that it might be misunderstood or be deemed civilly or culturally as something despicable. Do you follow so far? Now, if that's the case, then it answers some loose ends. It helps deal with some of the more problematic phrases, as if they're not all problematic in this. For example, verse 4, any man who prays or prophesies with something on his head disgraces his head. Do you know why? In a public setting, no man's going to wear a head covering. That's right. Verse 7. For a man ought not to have his head veiled since he's the image and glory of God. So what you have here is the man would be shamed if he wore a head covering because that wasn't public decorum. That wasn't expected. There was nothing that would make that to be something that a man would do. But I think there's even something deeper here going on in how the man should not have his head covered. And follow this if you can. You may or may not be familiar with this famous statue of Caesar Augustus. By the time of Corinth, people were celebrating the cult of the emperor. There was a cult house just blocks from any of the churches meeting in Corinth where they worshipped Caesar Augustus as Pontifex Maximus, the supreme ruler. And the supreme ruler was worshipped as a god. And when the supreme ruler would make pronouncements occasionally, he would follow what the pagans' priests did when they made supreme announcements, and he'd put a covering over his head just like you have there. You know how some politicians want to act like they're religious and they'll go through some gestures to make it look like, you know, they share the same paganism or the same religion that other people do, and they'll do things? That's what this statue is about. That Caesar is not only worshipped as a god, but he is taking on the garb of a priest in a pagan temple who has authority in that temple and makes prophetic pronouncements in that temple. But his prophetic pronouncements are not just good, they are Maximus. He's Pontifex Maximus. What he says has supreme authority because he's a god walking the earth. I don't think Paul wants in any way for any of his male prophecy people, his male preachers, to have any connection to this guy. Because Jesus is Lord, not Caesar. I don't think he wants his male preachers to have any connection to the pagan priest who put on the veil, who put on the covering when they're going to make their pronouncements. So you can see why he would say it's shameful for the man to have that on his head. He's imitating the pagans. He's playing their game. Just as it's shameful for the woman to disregard the proper decorum because it is a public setting. That's why he's giving a different read on the different sexes. Not because he's trying to be sexist, but because in his day there were different expectations for the different sexes here. And so I think that's what's going on. It answers that loose end. It also answers the loose end, and you can see the headdress a little bit more clearly there. It also answers the challenge of verse 5 and 6. If any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled disgraces her head, it is one and the same thing as having her head shaved. For if a woman will not veil herself, then she should cut off her hair. But it's disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or to be shaved. She should wear a veil. Here's what Paul's doing here, in my opinion. He's saying, hey, some of you, and it wasn't perhaps all, maybe even one, but some of you think you're so liberated and free that you're just free to prophesy with everyone's attention on your wild, loose hair, with all the suggestions that brings, or everyone's focus on the fact that you're not following a public decorum. Well, if you really don't care about public decorum, if you really don't care about the perception of other people, liberated woman, shave your head. To which that liberated woman say, no, I'm not going to shave my head. To which he says, I've called your bluff. You do care. Are you following me? You do care. You care enough that you won't go all the way. So if you really don't care, do it. But you won't, will you? So I've called your bluff. So I think that's what's going on in there. It finally also deals with perhaps the most curious statement in this entire thing, 10b. A woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. What's going on with because of the angels? And I think Paul has such a deep and profound sense of the importance of worship that whenever the community of Christ people meet together, they are meeting together with all the angels, with all the saints, with all, you know, this beautiful harmony of heaven surrounding them. And he understands that the angels, as they look in upon our worship, they, who are the most glorious beings other than God, they fall infinitely, but, you know, they outshine human beings. Isaiah 6, with two wings the angels covered their head, with two their body, and with two they flew. That even the angels, these angelic, spiritual, exalted beings, cover. They have no problem with it. Because they understand what they're doing as they worship God is they're involved in something so momentous, something so wondrous. The last thing they should worry about is, you know, trying to exalt themselves. They want to be perceived as in the proper place. So for a man, he needs to not prophesy with something on his head because he needs to show respect for his head, Christ. For a woman, she needs to wear a headdress to show respect to her head, Christ, as well, by maintaining proper decorum, not being misunderstood as sexually suggestive or a prostitute, and not being confused with someone in pagan revelry. That seems to be, to me, what's happening. That I think, explains most. It doesn't smooth out all the wrinkles, but it smooths out most, which then leads Paul to his conclusion in verse 13. He leaves it up to them. And I love this. This is classic Paul. He gives his opinion and then he says, judge for yourselves. All right? Yeah, you guys are going to have to make this decision. I'm still on this mission trip writing this letter to you. I'm not going to be around for a while. So, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered, not unveiled? And what he means is pray and prophesy. So, hair let loose, drawing attention to self, perhaps even sexually suggestive to at least some. Is it proper? He'll say, in your culture, is that proper? I'm leaving it up to you. Then he throws in some arguments to try to say, you know, this is just trying to work this out. Doesn't nature, and when Paul uses the word nature, he doesn't use it like we do, because Paul would have no concept of our mother nature. We invented mother nature because we wanted to stop talking about God the Creator. So we have this mother nature who, you know, is just nature apart from God. But for Paul, he doesn't think of nature that way. For him, nature just means culture. It's just, this is how culture works. Because, you know, God's the creator. Everything's God. All things bring glory to God. So when he talks about nature, he's talking about the nature of how things roll out in a human society. And so he says, in our Corinthian society, doesn't it teach if a man wears long hair, it's degrading to him? And it is said that, you know, we see movies and people have hair down to there. That's not considered long hair for Paul. It's like here. But again, he's talking about his culture. Just saying in our culture that it would be seem effeminate, it would seem wrong. Doesn't that have any play? But if a woman has long hair, if she has a covering, and now he's using this in a way to just draw attention to the need for covering, it's her glory. It's given to her as a covering. Shouldn't it be used in a way that brings honor to God and not in a way that brings a sexual suggestiveness or a misunderstanding for others? But then he ends by saying, if anyone wants to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. Which is to say, if you want to keep arguing about this simple solution I see to a simple problem, you can go ahead. But you do know, this isn't just me, but all of the churches in the Greco-Roman world that he's planted, he's talking about his Gentile churches, they're all practicing it this way, so why are they the exception to the norm? And that becomes a nice weight to help them make their decision that everyone else is doing it the way Paul says, why are they the one exception? And that's a question we sometimes have to ask ourselves. If we go rogue, if we decide to go rogue on something, you know, the weight of how other people view things should have some weight for how we consider things. Well, there's my best attempt. And as always, I try to give three reflections. But what do you reflect off this? So, here's my best attempt at three reflections. By the way, don't mind if you sit this one out. If you didn't follow or don't agree with anything I said, it's no sweat off my back. I really don't care. All right? So please don't come and argue with me. I honestly have no skin in the game. So just understand, I'm doing my best to try to help you with what I think is one of those things that you could have skipped out on. However, I do think there are some things we can learn. And this, I'm more encouraged to have you at least nod your head a little with me, and that is, when we're dealing with difficult passages that have cultural components that are foreign to us with such a great cultural distance, we need to have some humility. No one today would think wild loose hair suggests sexual availability. Nobody. And if they do, they are in need of some reinstructing, because no one would think that doesn't suggest it in our culture. It's just good hair. Hey, you know, and I'm a big fan. I like big hair, small hair, all hair. I like no hair. I like it all. But no one would think that it's sexual availability. So this isn't our problem. No one would think that the presence of a head covering means you're respectable and dignified. They might think you're backwards. I mean, just none of these things translate, which shows why we need some hermeneutical honesty when we deal with passages like this. And this isn't the only one. There are others like this. I feel like we should never pretend to understand more we do, but we just must humbly admit our shortcomings. But the most important thing under this reflection is when we come to difficult passages like this, please, God, make no major doctrines from difficult and obscure text. Don't try to root, you know, a very important issue on a text that is so, so difficult. You're just asking for trouble. But there are evangelical Christians who have made this their foundation for male headship.
If you read this right, you'll see the man's the head of the household, males are head. That's just it.
I mean, that it's true. I can point you to websites. They've taken obscure text. I also know others who've taken this and said, see, long hair on a man's always bad. And it's like, really? You're going to take, even the Baptist pastor I served under for 10.5 years, I had, because you know I had long hair when I was younger, I had a mullet which kicked butt back in the, you know, in the day. Now you look at the pictures and I'm very embarrassed. But I had a mullet which was considered long hair in the Baptist church, and elders would come up to Pastor Kimber and say, don't you know that this passage says long hair is a shame? And Kimber would say, I don't know what this passage is saying.
I have no idea. I don't get it.
And he'd write them off. And I thought, good for you, because he wasn't going to let them take an obscure reference and build an edifice of doctrine off of it. So that's one thing we can learn when we're dealing with difficult text. Let's build doctrine off what's clear, what's evident, what is obvious. You know, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I'll die for that. I'm not going to die for head coverings, for, against, long hair or any of this stuff. I'm actually going to shrug and shoulder and say, whatever. All right. Second thing is, I really think if you pay close attention to Paul here, you don't see a misogynist. You see someone trying to show mutuality, interdependence, that man is for woman, woman for man, man comes from woman, woman comes from man, all come from God. And the very fact that he allows women, and in fact encourages the women, to inhabit a role that in his culture no one else will let them inhabit, to pray and prophesy publicly, to have authority, to be the head of the church, to be a position of entitlement at the top, shows that he is light years beyond others as far as female liberation. So I find it very frustrating when people want to anachronistically read the scriptures and say, well, Paul's just a sexist. He is light years ahead of wherever they think they are, no matter how progressive they are right now. He's light years ahead in his culture. Thirdly, and lastly, believe it or not, clothes still matter. And that's where this becomes a little bit interesting. Because it might seem odd, some of the things here in this text, but in our culture, a man wouldn't go to a dinner party wearing a bathing suit. Right? He wouldn't go to a wedding wearing a baseball cap. A woman wouldn't go to a beach picnic wearing a wedding dress. As progressive as we think we are, it's advanced, clothes still matter. Decorum still matters. Because those things aren't just a breach of good manners. There's a sense in which if a guy goes to a dinner party wearing a bathing suit, you know he's a self-seeker. He wants to draw all attention to him. He could give a rip about the others around him and how they feel and whether they feel like they're part of this. He just wants to indulge himself. We know that. We know that innately, even though we say we're open to all. There is a sense in which that Paul is addressing something that we still feel in some way that, you know, at times there are appropriate things and there are things that are not appropriate. There's a certain decorum that should be followed unless it's just way backwards. And we are no further advanced in this than perhaps they were. We just have different items in which we're doing. In Paul's day, if a man wore a covering, he'd be associated with the pagan worship of the cult of emperor. I mean, that's a big thing. You guys would find it funny if I came here dressed in a military suit and I've never been in the military. You say, there's something really wrong with Rich. Right? That's not fitting. Why is he drawing all... Or if I came in a toga. You'd just think... You'd probably laugh for a second. You'd wonder, what's the children's sermon today? Because obviously it's odd. Because you trust me. But there would be a sense, if there were no reason other than I wanted to wear a toga, there really is a sense in which I'm just drawing attention to myself. If the women let their hair down in Paul's day, it had the same effect as it would in our church if someone came in and all the women were wearing bikinis. I mean, it's that idea. You're not going to come up and preach with a bikini. You might get a lot of people coming to your church. They're coming for the wrong reason. But do you see, I guess my point is, decorum still matters, and I think the challenge we have is to be compassionate and to be welcoming and try to be understanding, but there is a certain sense in which we may think we're beyond this, but we're not beyond this, because if we did certain things, there'd be people saying, you know, you're drawing my attention off the prophecy, off the praying, off the worship, you're focusing on yourself, you need to follow what is at least respectable decorum, because you don't want to publicly shame the congregation, which was what happened in Paul's day, and you don't want to publicly shame your head, Christ Jesus, because that's who this is all about in the first place. You're trying to point to Him and not to yourself. So that's the best I can do. Would you pray with me?